Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock talking with Joe Roman. Joe, you are also a physicist by training. Given what happened in Japan, where do you personally stand on the role of nuclear power as a way to reduce our greenhouse gases?
Well, you know, I've written a great deal about nuclear power. And, you know, the first thing that must be said is avoiding catastrophic global warming. That is the single greatest challenge for the human race. So we need to keep as many options open as possible for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Nuclear power certainly is one of those options. At the same time, nuclear power has become exceptionally expensive. And I did a post on climate progress, which based on a study that was done last year, which showed that over the last two or three decades, the price of new power plants has actually kept going up. You know, most new technologies have a learning curve where they come down in price, like solar power has come down in price dramatically over the last two or three decades, and wind power has come down. But nuclear power has gone up in price, and it is so expensive that nobody in, you know, you could virtually impossible to find a major utility in this country that is willing to purchase a new nuclear power plant just on economic grounds. You know, in the United States, we've put in all these amazing subsidies where the U.S. taxpayer is completely on the hook if there is a major nuclear accident. That's the Price-Anderson Act. At the same time, in the last few years, we've put in place these loan guarantees where new power plants, 80% of the cost of a new power plant is guaranteed by these taxpayer loans. So, you know, with all this, the American taxpayers are covering the risk, the financial risk, and the disaster risk. And even so, it is virtually impossible to find a utility that is willing to spend what has now become $8 or $10 billion for a new nuclear power plant.
I'm kind of laughing because it sounds a little bit like nuclear socialism to me, and nobody likes that word socialism. Well, look, I'd like to move on to some of the new climate research. I was really impressed with a study just published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. The title was Impacts of a Recent Storm Surge on the Arctic Delta Ecosystem Examined in the Context of the Last Millennium. That doesn't sound exciting, but it was a bit frightening to me. Can you explain why an obscure Arctic event matters to the rest of us?
Yeah, this was actually, I hadn't even really ever heard of this storm. We here in the United States often don't hear about things that happen in Canada. I have tried to report on these. But yeah, there was a study that was done at the Queen's University which looked at this 1999 storm, and it showed that it was the worst storm of its kind in a thousand-year history of this lake ecosystem, and it had, even 10 years later, this lake had not recovered, and large tracts of land near this lake had been permanently changed. And the point of this study was just to say that all those people out there saying, well, you know, what we're seeing now is just stuff we've seen before, all I'll say is in the last two or three decades, the extreme climate that we've been pushing with climate change and greenhouse gases is now moving us into a realm of extreme events that really are unprecedented. I mean, these are once-in-a-thousand-year events, and the Arctic is especially vulnerable, as you know, and as the ice retreats, it is dramatically changing the entire ecological system of the Arctic, and the peoples who live up there, you know, fully understand that the way of life is being forever changed.
Well, sure, this happened back in 1999, and it was the Aboriginal people, the Inuit, who alerted scientists to it, and they came and they had a really good setup to study what would happen if you got a similar salt surge, let's call it, hitting Chesapeake Bay or around San Francisco, which should possibly happen as the sea is rising. And we're picturing the ocean rising gently year by year, a little millimeter here and there. But in fact, a sea surge like this can change that coastal biology and maybe even the economy in just one big event. Are we really ready for this?
Well, I think that is the key point. I mean, you know, the coastlines of the world, they've been toughened up by storm surges over many years. But as when the sea level rises even 1 or 2 feet, now the ocean is hitting parts of the land that have you know, are not used to the severe storm. So when the severe storm comes, you're talking about, yes, a devastating storm surge. And you know, this is precisely what we're going to see because, of course, the storms themselves are getting more extreme. And you're seeing violent storms that are the equivalent of hurricanes occurring in the Midwest. We had a devastating storm that was sort of the equivalent of a hurricane. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're going to see the combination of sea level rise and these superstorms, I think, are going to be very devastating on coastal areas.
Our guest, Joe Rome, is with the Center for American Progress. On the political front, while the U.S. Congress, Joe, is floundering in climate science denial, I see in your blog the Australian Climate Commission has just come out with a report saying warming is real and the country needs to get ready. They don't leave much doubt about it. What did you have to say about that in your blog?
Yeah, that was a very good report. I mean, you know, scientists, and I am, you know, I have a PhD in physics, and I report a great deal on scientists. They tend to, you know, couch their language a lot, and so when scientists speak bluntly, people ought to be worried because it takes a lot to get scientists to be that concerned that they're willing to just be very straightforward. So this Australian Climate Commission just had a very good report. In fact, they titled it The Critical Decade, and they basically said that either we take strong action now, you know, or, quote, the global climate may be so irreversibly altered we will struggle to maintain our present way of life. And we are talking about potential warming this century of 5 or 6 degrees centigrade, I mean 10 degrees Fahrenheit, creating an utterly different planet in many respects. And the report was just blunt. You know, there's no doubt the climate is changing. Evidence is overwhelming and clear. They use the phrase we use in America a lot. You know, we know beyond reasonable doubt that human emissions of greenhouse gases are the primary cause. So, you know, if this were a criminal case and you were looking for the criminal who's causing the climate change, it's us. You know, we're the ones who are creating the change. We're the perpetrators. And so it's a very good report. It also spends a lot of time talking about the strategy needed to reduce emissions, and I commend that to people. Obviously, Australia is going through a lot of political turmoil itself over the carbon tax and how it's going to reduce its emissions. And, you know, it's been frustrating that there's been this massive disinformation campaign, which I think has greatly muddied the waters about what stuff that is relatively obvious, which is our urgent need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Yes, and we need the Australians to stop expanding the railways that carry the coal out for export to China and many other countries. That's helping global warming as well.
Well, look, every country's doing it. You got Canada with the tar sands. You know, we have the United States with its large use of coal and oil. China is obviously been building coal plants at a rapid rate. It is a problem where all the nations have to come together and solve this problem the way that we save the ozone layer and you know, basically, you know, shut down production of most chlorofluorocarbons. And that was a nick of time thing. I mean, people don't remember that ozone hole opened up, and that really sobered people up and got them to finally agree to relatively strong, you know, ozone-destroying substances constraints. So we need adults. I mean, we need some adults to step in and say everybody's got to take action.
Well, then I have to ask, Joe Rome, are we really making any climate progress at all?
No.
I mean, let's talk some good news stories, the solutions that could get us out of this energy mess without collapsing civilization, please. Could you talk to us about geothermal maybe or solar and wind? Where's the progress?
Well, you know, look, the clean energy technologies are ready. They're raring to go. I had a long talk with Robert Sokolow of Princeton University, who developed this approach called the wedges, where you look at the technologies needed to address climate change. And he remains as even more of a believer today than when he wrote the article 5 or 6 years ago, that we have the technologies needed today to aggressively deploy clean energy cost-effectively and reverse our emissions trends. And yeah, we're talking solar power, which has come down in price by, you know, a factor of 20 in the past 30 years, the solar photovoltaic. We're talking about new forms of solar. which include, you know, where you have the mirrors, concentrated solar thermal in the desert. You reflect the mirrors onto tubes of liquids that you heat up to boiling. Wind power obviously has become the biggest form of new renewables. And you have geothermal, where you use the Earth's heat, and there's a lot of new technologies. We just did a post on sort of five hot new geothermal companies and their technologies. And energy efficiency. I mean, I do not want to, you know, forget to mention energy efficiency, whether it's LED lighting or smart controls or better heating and cooling systems. Their opportunities just to cut people's energy bills and save energy, you know, remain very large. So we don't have to go to zero emissions tomorrow, but we have to get off of our emissions path as soon as possible. And the technologies, there is absolutely no question that they exist and that they're ready to go when governments get serious about them.
So we could do it. Can you name any countries that have actually reduced their greenhouse gas emissions, really?
Sure. Many countries in Europe have. Germany has, and Great Britain has. In fact, Great Britain has just a week or two ago, the climate secretary said that Great Britain will cut its greenhouse gas emissions to 50% below 1990 levels by within about 15 years, continuing their reductions of the last decade or so. And, you know, we've seen countries like Denmark who've been aggressively deploying, you know, renewables. And these are remarkable achievements, given that the United States has refused to go along on a global deal, and yet other countries have realized that these technologies are the future, and whichever country leads the way in reducing the greenhouse gas emissions and deploying clean energy technologies, they're going to be the leader in these job-creating industries of the future.
As we head towards wrap-up, is there anything else you'd like to add that our listeners should hear about?
Everyone, I think, needs to become informed on this issue. I speak at college campuses and tell these are the jobs of the future, these skill sets. I tell young people, I mean, you know, I usually start by apologizing for our generation not acting swiftly enough to reduce emissions. But these are the jobs that surround giving people food, a sustainable agricultural system, dealing with water, water efficiency, clean energy, low carbon energy, understanding the climate system. You know, these are going to be some of the most important jobs of the future, and I think everyone needs to understand what's happening, and young people should see how they can contribute.
Well, listeners, as you've seen, Joe Rome has been an expert on major television networks, and he can get big radio coverage almost any time, but he still takes the time to speak to college audiences and community activists, and we really appreciate that about you, Joe Rome. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
A lot of things seem weird in the weather and the news, and one day we suddenly snap on one item, a kind of uh-oh moment as the reality sinks in. Does that happen to you? I'm Alex Smith. For me, it was just a town I've never been to. Last week, when this northern community suddenly burned down, I was shocked. Slave River, Alberta lost one-third of the town. Everyone, all 7,000 people, were evacuated as a wall of flames came in the night. The kicker? The premier of that Canadian province showed up to blame Mother Nature instead of the high-carbon tar sands he provides to the United States. That province is the largest provider of oil to the United States now. Forget about Saudi Arabia or Venezuela. But who cares what happens in some Canadian town we've never heard of? As you'll hear next from one of the world's top wildfire experts, there are things going on in the far north that could rock your world wherever you live. Listen to this. Unreported and uncontrolled fires in Canada's boreal forest burn vast areas every year. As the North heats faster than the rest of the world due to climate change, these fires are hotter and wilder, even creating their own weather systems. In a possible sign of the future, on May 15, 2011, with only minutes warning, really, the 7,000 residents of Slave Lake, Alberta, were forced to flee a wall of oncoming flames. Wildfires, are back in the news. The recognized expert is Dr. Mike Flanagan, a senior researcher with Natural Resources Canada, an expert for the Canadian Forest Service, and professor of wildland fire at the University of Alberta. Dr. Flanagan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Mike, I thought summer was fire season. These big fires in Canada's north so early in the spring, is that unusual?
Not for Alberta. We do get spring fires in Alberta. After the snow melts, there's about a four-week window where things are dry on the ground and the vegetation hasn't turned green. It hasn't greened up yet. And during this period, fires are fairly common in Alberta.
And could you tell us, why was the town of Slave Lake surprised by such a monster fire?
Well, I don't want to dwell on specifics like Slave Lake because I don't have all the information on Slave Lake. But what I can tell you is that fires can move rapidly when there's strong winds and dry weather like we've had in Alberta the last few weeks. So fires can move quickly, and if communities are in the path, they are at risk.
And I was surprised, you don't need to have a long-term drought to have a fire risk. These forests can dry out fairly quickly, is that right?
Well, much of the boreal, especially the boreal shield, has very shallow soils, such that there's a memory of only a few days to a week in those forest fuels. Regardless of how much rain you've had before that, if you have a week of warm, dry, windy weather, you can have a raging inferno. It's the forest fuels that really drives the fire situation. If the fuels get dry, fires can start and fires can spread.
And what part does the Rocky Mountain pine bark beetle play in this?
Well, I'm a fire person and not a bug person, but I have done a bit of reading on this, and vast areas of BC interior, mountain pine beetle has killed lodgepole pine. Now, these pine trees die, and they're standing there. Eventually, the wind will blow them over. But while they're standing, their needles go from an orange to a red to a gray. And during these periods, we are concerned about fire behavior, and this is a course of active investigation. And particularly the gray stage, which is 3 to 5 years after the death of the tree, the needles that are still left can spread quite quickly and cause spot fires in advance of the fire, so make it kind of accelerating the fire front. So it's a very dangerous situation if a fire gets up and running in these mountain pine beetle killed stands.
And I've read that climate scientists have predicted greater warming in the north, of course, in Canada and Russia and Alaska. Does that therefore lead to more fires or more intense fires, and is that actually happening yet?
Yes, and I'll just, if I can back up just a little bit, I'll answer that question. There's kind of three or four factors that influence fires. The first is, we kind of touched on, is the fuels and what type of fuel. Conifers burn easily, deciduous less so. How dry the fuels are important. Ignition, people, and lightning are the main agents of fire starts. And the third factor is weather, which I consider to be the most important. Hot, dry, windy weather are very important to fires. Now, in the future, the climate models, general circulation models, suggest that we're going to be a much warmer world, especially in northern latitudes, Russia, Siberia, Alaska, Canada. And with warmer temperatures come longer fire seasons, as fires will start earlier in the spring and go later in the fall. With warmer temperatures, there'll be more lightning activity. More lightning activity, the more fire starts you have. And the last reason is, the warmer it gets, the more evapotranspiration we have, and which means the fuels will be drier unless there's significant changes in precipitation, significant increases in precipitation. And for every degree Celsius warming, you need about a 10% increase in precipitation during summer. So much of northern Canada is looking at 4 to 6 degrees Celsius warming. You need an increase of 46% in precipitation, which the models don't suggest, though our confidence in precipitation is less than temperature. The end result is that fuels are drier, which means it's easier for fires to start and spread.
Yes, this is something I've had trouble understanding, because I've seen predictions that the northern limits will be actually growing wetter and wetter, and in past ages they were even tropical, almost humid forests. So how do we then get more forest fire activity out of that wet situation?
with the Arctic Ocean, the ice pack becoming seasonal, there will be more precipitation, especially in the autumn when the water is still open. You get kind of a lake effect or sea effect snowfall or rain event. But during the fire season, the warm season, as long as you have periods of drought, you can have forest fires. And with climate change, we expect more extreme weather, more extreme droughts, more extreme flooding. And when those droughts occur, fires can happen. And fires are not just restricted to the forest. We have a new study with NASA looking at tundra fires. And there's been some very large tundra fires in the last few years. And these appear to be becoming more common.
And for those who don't know what tundra is, what does that mean for us?
Well, tundra, it's so cold that trees cannot grow, generally because there's no summer warmth for the seed to be viable and for seedlings to be established. There's permafrost, that is, underneath the organic material, there's ice all year long. And there's grasses, forbs, herbs, and occasionally shrubs. And this is tundra. And there's also, interesting, a lot of hydrates that are stored in the permafrost. And if the warming continues and permafrost melts, these hydrates, methane, will be released, which are very effective greenhouse gases.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Canadian fire expert Dr. Mike Flanagan. Mike, how do we know that climate change is involved in wildfires? Who is doing research on this?
Well, there's a number of people around the world looking at this. In Canada, we've been working on it since the mid-1980s, if you can believe it, which is 25 years now, plus. And, you know, we've published work that suggests that the increases we've seen in fire activity in Canada is already the result of human-caused climate change. For example, in Canada, our average area burned in the 60s and 70s was about 1 million hectares a year. Currently, we burn about 2 million hectares a year, which is a doubling. 2 million hectares is about half the size of Nova Scotia, approximately the size of Massachusetts, to give it some context. And we've done a number of studies that suggest by the end of this century, we expect another doubling of area burned. In some papers for Western North America, Alaska, BC, Yukon, increases could be as high as fivefold. So five times more fire than we currently see.
That's a whole new landscape for living you're describing. You know, back in November 2007, I interviewed Dr. Tom Gower. He said Canada's boreal forests are no longer a carbon sink. They are a net source of global warming gases. I know that's a huge question, but I want to ask if you would agree with that. And do wildfires add to the carbon burden, or are they kind of carbon neutral?
It's actually disturbances like insects and fire that make our boreal forest a carbon source rather than a sink. And the larger aspect is that about 20% of our boreal forest is wetlands or peatlands. And with more drought, these will become vulnerable to burning. And they store vast amounts of carbon, and it's kind of a legacy carbon. It's been building up over thousands and thousands of years. And greenhouse gas releases from these peat fires can be significant on the global scale. Previous studies done in Indonesia suggest that peat fires in Indonesia released 20 to 40% of global fossil fuel emissions in 1 year. And the peat reserves, the peat and carbon reserves in Canada and Siberia completely dwarf anything in Indonesia. So if these peatlands begin to burn, they burn already, and they go into the ground, they smolder, and they can burn right through winter and then start up again in the spring. With more extreme droughts, more and more of these peatlands could burn and release significant amounts of greenhouse gases, which would feed the warming, a positive feedback, if you like.
Well, what about wildfires further south? In BC, the city of Kelowna, with almost 250,000 people, has been threatened by fire twice. And if the planet heats up as predicted, well, we had the Russian capital was threatened in 2010. Do you think major cities will be at more risk from uncontrollable fires?
Anywhere where there's communities or people in the forest or near the bush, they are at risk. And with global warming, climate warming, we expect this risk to increase. And we only have to look around the globe. It's not just a Canadian situation. In recent years, there's been fires in in Russia, as you mentioned. The year before, February 2009, there were catastrophic fires in Australia. There's been catastrophic fires in Greece, in California. This is a global phenomenon, and it's only going to get worse.
Well, how do we need to rethink fires and fire planning in response to that?
There's already a few strategies at hand to help communities as well as homeowners. In Canada, it's called FireSmart. In the United States, it's called FireWise. And these are guidelines to help homeowners protect their homes. And a lot of it's just common sense. Don't have cedar shakes on your roofs. Most homes build down because of embers falling on the rooftop and the roof catching fire. Also, do not stack firewood against your home. Don't have burnable shrubs near your right adjacent to your house. Things like that. But also for communities, building fire guards around the community. And by that, we mean reducing the fuels close to town or the community. And this can be done mechanically by chainsaws and just removing the forest fuels, putting pavement in if you like, or grass and sprinklers. And you can also use prescribed burning to burn the regions adjacent to communities to protect them from fire in the future. So I often say you can have a little smoke now in a managed way or a lot of smoke later in an uncontrolled fashion.
Right. Well, as we wrap up, do you have any tips on good articles or websites about wildfires that our listeners could go to?
Well, there's the Canadian Forest Service has an excellent website on fire. And if you just say Canadian Forest Service wildland fire, it should get you there. I don't have the website right beside me, but if you Google or Bing that, I'm sure it will get there. Or Canadian Wildland Fire Information System should get you there as well.
Thank you so much. We'll have to wrap up there. Our guest on Radio EcoShock has been Canadian wildfire expert Dr. Mike Flanagan. He was editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Wildland Fire from 2002 to 2008. He's got over 200 published papers in his career so far. So, Dr. Flanagan, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. Find out more at ecoshock.org. Last weekend, I went to our mountain retreat. The local river was raging and brown, thundering down the canyon, carrying 80-foot trees like matchsticks. I felt the power, and I felt small. Food and energy prices are cutting into all of our lives. Governments at all levels look bankrupt and powerless. We may be running out of oil, and we are well off compared to the 2 billion of the planet's poorest people. The seasons are getting out of sync. The weather is breaking down. Somewhere across the planet, 3 nuclear reactors have melted down out of control, and we hardly hear about that. We are small, you and I, but we can be a lot bigger together. Check out our shows on building local community, the transition movement, and living happier with less. Please support your local radio station. We're going to need the alternative to big corporate press. If you can send a letter, an email, or a phone call to your local station, ask them to carry Radio EcoShock. While the Earthbeat Show reorganizes, we need to keep green radio going. Let folks know you want more environmental coverage with Radio EcoShock. You can find our website with all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org. The blog for this program is at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening, and I hope to find you here again next week. Mother.